Back to the latest edition of The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Bruce Feldman, joined, as always, by my colleague from The Athletic, Stuart Mandel. Stu, as we taped on Sunday, we had some coaching news. That was at LSU. Less than 24 hours later, or about 24 hours later, there was another big bombshell announcement, and it came out of the Pac-12 and Washington State. Nick Rolovich is out as the Cougars head coach, as well as four of his assistants. It's pretty rare that you see half a staff get lopped off at midseason, especially when they've won the last couple of games. But obviously, there are some big extenuating circumstances. What do you make of the situation in Pullman?
It's been a 2 month, we've known since August that this day would come unless he had a change of heart. So it's been like a kind of a slow motion train wreck. And now that it's happened, and like you said, I think the perhaps the most significant part is that it's not just the head coach. We've seen plenty of schools have to play with an interim head coach. It's half the staff. And they've got a game against BYU this weekend. And there's only so many GAs and whatnot that you can promote. And by the way, they've been playing very well. They've won three games in a row. They're in contention for the Pac-12 North title after a 1-3 start. What happens from here? How do you game plan? How do you get in enough instruction with the guys on a week-to-week basis?
Well, I had asked on the Zoom call, I'd asked Pat Chun, the AD, about this part of what we're talking about, of the dynamic, which is the contingency plans. I'd heard that they were sorting out to try to add assistants. And he said, you got to keep in mind, so it's not just Nick Rolovich, the head coach. It's the offensive line coach as well as the offensive coordinator. And Nick Rolovich is a hands-on, offensive-minded guy. That is a big chunk of what, essentially is their run-and-shoot offense. And as Chun said, there's just not a lot of guys on the street who are versed in that system who are available to coach it. I had a back-and-forth with a college coach who is like, maybe they should try to get Mouse Davis. I know he's available. Mouse Davis is 89 years old, but he was.
that's a good point. Like that, he left and he left behind an offense that hardly anybody. I think they may be the only program that runs it at this point. So you can't just sub in some random offensive coordinator.
June Jones, from my understanding, is not going to do it. June Jones is a mentor to Nick Rolovich. As I said, Mouse Davis is 89. I found out, by the way, you know where he was born? Palouse, Washington, of all places. He never coached there, but he was born there.
Huh. So, what are the odds of that?
A million to one? I don't know. In all seriousness, Jake Dickard, who's the defensive coordinator, he has taken over as the interim head coach. This team has, as you said, they basically control their own destiny in the Pac-12 North. It's just the whole dynamic is really bizarre, how it has played out. It's already politicized. It is going to get, I suspect, much more so as more people who maybe aren't college football fans or versed in it.
Yeah. His lawyer sent an email out to the media, Wednesday morning that he's going to take legal action against the school. You knew that was coming. Look, the players clearly loved Coach Rolovich. He had lots of supportive messages on social media. A lot of the players were frustrated that it came to this. And I just feel like it's one of those situations where it's kind of going to fall on the players. Like they can rally together and this could become a bonding thing, and they could go on to have a really good season. Or all of the chaos and not knowing who your position coach is going to be and all the things you just said, could completely derail it.
Yeah, on top of it, those players have already been through a lot, especially the upperclassmen. They've had two teammates die in their time there, and that's hard. That's for, especially for people of that age, to deal with that kind of tragedy, and teammates no less. is excruciating. They have been through, you know, coaching changes. Now they're going to be going through another one, in addition to obviously going through a, you know, coping with a pandemic on top of that. I mean, that is, you know, a devastating kind of emotional roller coaster that they're on. And, you know, we'll see where the story goes. I mean, you know, as far as the where they look after this, I mean, right now they have a season to complete. And so I think, unlike, you know, USC, unlike to some extent LSU, where the administration and the AD can really focus on the search, I think in this case, Pat Chung and the administration really have to focus on how do we help this team get to the rest of the season, because you have essentially half a staff. And as you alluded to, this isn't Alabama or Georgia where you have like 20 analysts who are off the books, or not off the books, but like, you know, not on field coaches who are usually experienced and could jump right in. This is not a program with that kind of resources. So it's just a, I don't know. It's a very, very awkward, messy situation in Pullman.
The interesting thing about that job is, I think we kind of automatically, oftentimes, when we talked about Leach and what he did there, we always kind of default to, it's such a hard job. It's in the middle of nowhere. There's not a great recruiting base. However, you look at the last, I don't know, 25 years of Washington State, Mike Price took them to 2 Rose Bowls. Leach had an 11-win season. It's still very early, or what would have been Rolovich's tenure, but they're doing okay right now. Being the end of the day, like, the right coach can win there, and it's a Power 5 job. It's one of the probably lower resourced Power 5 jobs, but it's a Power 5 job. So I do think there would be coaches interested in that. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the names that you included on your list?
Yeah, I think one of the first names that I suspect they will consider is Jay Norvell. He's done a really good job at Nevada. He's coached in the Pac-12. He's a good offensive coach. He has, you know, Carson Strong might be the first quarterback taken in the NFL draft upcoming. He's helped develop him. And so I could see Jay Norvell, especially where, you know, you follow up Mike, and you and I both know him very well. He's a terrific coach, but Mike can be a handful to manage. And that's, you know, just putting it bluntly. But, and then you had Rolovich, and I'll be honest, I thought this was going to be a really good hire and work out great for them. And it obviously, you know, has not, for all sorts of reasons that probably no one could have anticipated, you know, back when they hired him. But I think coming off of that, where you have two really, really outside the box thinkers, you know, and some of that I think is why they're really good offensive minds, you know, being outside the box thinkers. But I think they may be looking for somebody a little more buttoned up and a little, you know, I don't know what the way to say it more than buttoned up, that just from a management side of it, I could see, you know, you and I both have had Jay Norvell as a guest on this podcast. He's impressive when you hear his story and who he is, really impressive. I could see them looking at Kalen DeBoer from Boise State. He's going to be a big time coach. Yeah, I'm sorry, what did I say? Boise State. Yeah, Kalen DeBoer from Fresno. He's won national titles at the NAIA level. He was impressive. Offensive coordinator at Indiana. I know from talking to coaches in that league, they thought he was really good. I think he's destined for bigger things. And then after that, you know, I don't know if they look at Brent Brennan. He came as the runner up for, you know, he's at San Jose State, was a runner up for Arizona last year. He spent a lot of time not in.
Boy, he
in
dodged
Pullman,
a bullet there.
I mean, wherever you go, though, you know, you knew they were going to be a major rebuild. So I don't know, you know, how much you dodge a bullet if it's like that's your chance to be in the, you know, yeah, to get a Pac-12 job. But, and then I think there's a handful of assistants. I mean, there's a bunch of guys who are at Oregon who I think all could get a look, starting with Joe Moorhead. Joe Moorhead's actually the one assistant at Oregon who doesn't have Wazoo ties, who I think is a candidate. You know, there are guys who are very interested. Jeff Banks, who was a player there and is a, you know, Mike Price protege and has a lot of people in his corner. He was on Alabama staff. He's a guy that is a really good recruiter who I think will get a push. At least I know he will, from some people who are influential there. I just, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what they do next after how this thing has unfolded, in terms of like, who do you want to hire in the wake of a lot of tumultuous stuff in Pullman.
Let me throw another wrinkle into it, Bruce. Things are not going well for Jimmy Lake at Washington. They're 2-4. Who knows where it ends up from here? Is there any possibility that both jobs in the state of Washington would be open?
I don't think they would. I don't think Jen Cohn would pull the plug on Jimmy Lake just 2 years into his tenure there. I would not be shocked if there was pressure on him to make an offensive coordinator change. I think that has been underwhelming. I would be surprised if they would pull the plug on Jimmy Lake 2 years in. I mean, he's a first-time head coach. The first year was in a pandemic. They know him because of his work as a defensive coordinator there. I'm not saying it's definitely not happening. I would be a little surprised.
I would be too. It just feels like in general, and maybe it's, I don't know, coming out, I don't know what the reason is. It feels like patience levels across the sport all of a sudden are becoming, I mean, look what just happened with Ed Ogeron. Like, some of the norms of, oh, you got to wait this. I mean, we've seen Willie Taggart fired after 2 years. We saw Chad Morris fired after 2 years. It used to be you got to give a guy 4 years. Then four became three.
By the way, those guys weren't fired after 2 years. They were fired before they got to even
like
2 years.
The window is starting to get less and less. And because of that, like, I'm sure Jen Cohen fully supports Jimmy Lake and wants Jimmy Lake to succeed. The fans are already calling for his head. Christian Capel, in his story off the UCLA game, said that the attendance was well below whatever they said it was, you know, reported that it was. So, look, if he can right things a little bit and they have a 500-ish season, I don't think that becomes it's not even a possibility. The question is, what happens if they end up going like 3-9?
I don't think they will. Just from looking at the rest of their schedule, I think it sets up reasonably well for them at least to get around there. I mean, they play Arizona next. Arizona's been awful. They play at Stanford. That's the toss-up game. They have at Colorado. Colorado's, you know, next to Washington State. I think they're the next, I'm sorry, next to Arizona, probably the worst team. And then they play, who knows what kind of shape Wazoo is going to be in. So I think there's a decent chance for them to get to 6-6. Especially now that they've gotten some of their best receivers healthy, which were not healthy at the beginning of the year. So I think at least that gives them a chance for some optimism, but the offense has got to get a lot better. I mean, right now that has been dragging for them, and I think we've seen that. I mean, look, you know, they had throughout the Arkansas State game, I mean, 13 points against Montana. They scored 10 at Michigan. Now they lit up Cal for 31. 24 at Oregon State and only 17 last week at UCLA. You got to get better on offense. You just have to.
One last thing on the Rolovich, and I'm going to read you this passage. So from our story on the site today about the Rolovich pursuing legal action, Chris Vanini answered the question, what does this mean for Rolovich's future? I'm going to read you this. And I'm going to ask you how much you may agree or disagree. He writes, it's hard to see him ever coaching in college football again. Clashing with your bosses over something like this is bound to make other presidents and athletic directors pass on hiring you, even at the assistant level. Suing them takes that to another level.
I would think that is the case. I definitely would. Having said that, I've seen a lot of instances where somebody sounded like they were on a hireable because they sued somebody, and then they landed at, you know,
Steve Sarkisian sued USC.
That's exactly where I was going. Who would have thought Steve Sarkisian would not only, he actually got arguably one of the top five jobs in college football. Now I'm not saying it's not undeserved. You know, he did a really good job and had arguably the best offense we've ever seen in college football last year that he had a big role in. But, you know, I think sometimes we just automatically assume that somebody's never going to get another shot. You know, on a somewhat similar vein in terms of people thought they had a comeuppance, and you know, Bobby Petrino basically has burned so many bridges, and he still lands jobs. And he, you know, after Louisville, he got another job. Hugh Freeze had an embarrassing exit from Ole Miss. He got, you know, he was out for a little while, but he got on at Liberty. I'm pretty sure that he's going to get a Power Five job at some point because he's a really successful football coach. I think the question is going to be, can whoever hires him or potentially hires him, do they feel like they can trust them? I mean, I think that comes back to it. Because at the end of the day, you know, I go back to something I think Charlie Weiss might have said when he was getting run out at Notre Dame. You know, it's like his graduation rate was probably like 99.8% or something, you know, like really strong. They don't, you know, fire you for, you're not going to get fired for not graduating players. You're not going to, it's if you, whether you win or you lose, you know, and, or if they think you are not winning enough. And if that's the deal, because they'll overlook a lot of stuff if you win.
I don't, I'm going to, I mean, I, maybe I'm crazy. I don't think this makes him unhireable. He's never going to, I don't think he's ever going to get another, you know, Power Five job that pays you $3.5 million a year. But this was a very specific situation. In a state, not most states don't have that kind of mandate. So, and you know, probably the best thing that could have happened is he ends his tenure there on a 3-game winning streak. If they were 1-6, that's going to be a harder sell. But now he, you know, was successful at Hawaii, and granted a very brief tenure at Washington State, but at least it was heading in the right direction. So, if I had to predict, assistant coach somewhere kind of obscure. And then maybe eventually a head coach again, maybe at the FCS level.
Yeah, look, if he was coaching, and I, you know, we mentioned a Petrino, and I don't want to ding Paul Petrino, broadside him on this, but like if he was coaching like 10 miles away for the Vandals in Idaho, this would probably, I don't want to say be a non-issue, but it certainly wouldn't have risen to the threshold it has because of the state he's in. So I think where some people are going to, you know, and these are including talk to some people who know Nick Rolovich really well, are like, you know, it's hard because now you've taken this position and it really impacts your players are in the middle of it. And a lot of your coaches, especially the ones who are vaccinated, you know, they're likely going to be out of jobs at the end of this season because of this. I think that's one thing. But as you said, it just depends on who's doing the hiring. And I also think what will factor into this, we know there's probably a lawsuit coming. Because that's what, you know, somebody, an attorney has put out there this morning. But I also think it's going to be what comes out and what he says, subsequently from this. Because honestly, Nick Rolovich has said almost nothing on this front. And there's been, you know, it's just been such a murky situation. I think until we know more of where he's, you know, kind of what he says on this, I think that'll also tell, you know, how comfortable certain people are going to be with hiring him.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, if his, I don't know what his goal end game is here. If he wanted to get another coaching job fairly soon, he would probably be best served not doing the legal action. And because I think as long as that's hovering out there, then he will be unhireable. It'll be once that clears.
Stu, while we're talking about legal matters, Tennessee, never a dull moment with that program. You know, obviously they had the crazy Saturday night when Lane Kiffin returned. And a few days later, Jeremy Pruitt, remember him, his attorney, Mike Lyons, has given University of Tennessee until October 29th, as we're taping, that's 9 days away, to reach a financial settlement with Pruitt or face a lawsuit that he says will include details of a myriad of NCAA rules violations in the football program and other sports as a result in debilitating NCAA sanctions. So buckle up, Tennessee, because he's going to dish all the dirt. What I thought was added a little spice to this, which is obviously Jeremy Pruitt got thrown way under the bus in that press conference where the chancellor was talking about level one violations. It was like, that was, you know, I don't know if we even go into that bizarre press conference where they're like lauding Phil Fulmer at the same time as basically realizing that they're, you know, they're lucky that they were able to get somebody as capable or competent, I guess, as they did in the hiring process. But in the face of that, in the face of this USA Today story, comes one of those coaches from another sport at Tennessee. This is from Rick Barnes, the basketball coach, who's in his seventh season there. I'm really disappointed that Jeremy would throw other people's names around that he knows did nothing but support him the entire time he was here and make those unsubstantiated claims. I would invite the NCAA to come in any day of the week and investigate our program. I have too much respect for our players, our school, and our administration for somebody to ever think we were not doing things right here and make such ridiculous statements. He goes on, Jeremy is not here because of the decisions he made and the way he led his program. Here's what I know. Our university has done everything it possibly can in working with the NCAA to clean up the mess he left behind and bring this to closure. Ouch.
Pay the money, Tennessee. I don't know what kind of dirt he actually, that Pruitt's lawyer has or doesn't have on Rick Barnes or anybody else at the University of Tennessee. It doesn't matter. Why do you want to go through this? Pay him the money and it all goes away. Why would you want to get into a protracted fight where they're going to sling mud at each other and it's just not good for anybody? And the lengths they have gone through to try to avoid paying this buyout, I mean, I would just point to the fact that this lawyer that's representing Pruitt also represented David Beatty in Kansas. Now, that was a smaller amount of money at stake. But Kansas tried to do the same thing, pin NCAA violations on him. And to avoid paying, what was it, like a $500,000 buyout? It wasn't anything major. And after they took depositions, Jeff Long said some things under oath that did not look good. And they ended up basically paying him $50,000 less than they would have. So pay the money, Tennessee. Don't do this to yourself. I don't think they will. It sure sounds like they're going to dig in their heels.
I think Tennessee is going to end up paying them the money.
But when? Like, will it be before this thing goes to court, or will they?
No one's told me this. This is a guess. I have not. For everything you just said, if you're Tennessee, you have been I'm going to curse here for a second. You have been a ship magnet of colossal proportions. It's just like that fan base has been through way too much. Now, all of a sudden, you're going to have a coach who has been in the middle of it for a couple of years, has a big staff. I don't doubt that there's a lot of, and I'm not saying it's Rick Barnes's program, but like, you don't want him airing, knowing where some of the bodies are buried.
And there's bodies buried at every athletic department in America.
This is not a Tennessee, like, this is what I would say. You and I have talked about this a lot in the podcast over the years. It's rare when some school gets really broadsided by people saying there's cheating going, because it almost, usually the people who are aggrieved are not the people who would come out. Meaning, like, Albert Means happened because there was a high school coach pissed off. Miami blew up in the Yahoo reporting scandal because Nevin Shapiro was like an unconventional booster that he wasn't really tied to the school. He was like a friend of the program who gave a lot of money, and he wasn't, got sideways with it. In this case, you have a former coach who knows a lot of stuff, who is out money, who I don't think, Jeremy Pruitt is probably not getting much of a head coaching job anytime soon. He's with the Giants now. Somebody will hire him as his defensive coordinator at some point, I'm sure. But I don't think anybody looks at him and say, after what he did at Tennessee, and go, yeah, he's going to get a good head coaching job. But the money he would get, I think, is like, that's what is on the table. And I just don't think it's worth it for them to mess with him on this.
The buyout that he was owed is $12.6 million. That's a lot of money in the real world. But by recent college coach buyout standards, that's actually pretty modest. LSU is paying Ed Orgeron more than that to go away. Texas paid Tom Herman more than that to go away. Just
Gus Malzahn got way more than that to go away.
By the way, I misspoke about David Beatty's buyout. It was supposed to be $3 million, not whatever I said, $500,000. That was the difference.
Also, David Beatty also was put on the shelf. Like, he couldn't get a job at the University of Texas when I think there was a chance there. It was just kind of put his career on. KU really kind of screwed him.
He was supposed to get $3 million, and the settlement ended up being 2.55. So, and the difference, Kansas spent as much on legal fees, in terms of the difference there. And David Beatty was actually, ended up being cleared of the violation. Jeremy Pruitt is not going to be cleared, it doesn't sound like, or at least his program won't be. But that doesn't mean, I still don't think that's worth a protracted legal battle. As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. And I'll start out with this one from Alex Buskin. It's very timely. When the news about Ed Orgeron's separation agreement broke, I wondered about his next coaching job. Could you see him as a replacement for Manny Diaz at Miami if they let Diaz go after this season or next year? I know it's been a long time since Orgeron was at Miami, but they did have a lot of success while he was on the staff there. If not a place like Miami, do you see him end up being a head coach somewhere else, or has that ship sailed due to the bad publicity at LSU?
Alex, I do not think he is going to be a head coach again. I don't think he's going to be. I'm not saying it won't happen. I don't think he's going to coach football after this. A couple of reasons why. One, he is 60, and I think he has realized, you know what? He's had some perspective on it. I think he honestly is like, where do you go when you just had your dream job? You led them to a national title. I'm not sure what the next step would be for him. I don't see he's been in the NFL as an assistant. That I don't think he loved that. I don't see him wanting to be somebody's D-line coach or recruiting coordinator. And then these other jobs, I just don't see him, you know, wanting to pursue it. Miami is interesting on two fronts. Let's say even if it does come open, which it probably will, but we don't know that for sure at this point, is when he was at Miami, it was a different life for him. You know, this was before he's been sober for a little over 20 years now. But at that point, that was when his life was really out of control. I don't necessarily think, I think he has some affinity for the place. Look, he's still friendly with Jimmy Johnson. He's close to The Rock, who actually has the money to make almost anything happen Miami football wise. But I just don't think at this stage of his life, he wants to go jump back into it. At least that's my understanding of where he's at right now. A lot of that could change, but I don't think he's coaching anywhere in 2020.
He said at his press conference, he does not intend to coach next year. So I'll take him at his word for that. I guess the question is, after a year being out, does he get restless and miss it and want to get back into it? And if so, in what kind, at what level, at what kind of role?
Yeah, I don't know. My guess is, I suspect he may try to do some TV somewhere.
He would have the most unique voice on television.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I remembered we used him once for our CBS signing day show. And the night before, I said, like, it was a recruiting class. And I said, can you gave him a list of what we wanted. And there was about a minute and a half, or maybe a minute, 5 minutes, where he just kind of went off for like about each individual player. It's like, yeah, we really could have used video over this, because just him talking over the phone was just like, I don't know. I think him in the studio would be different than him, like, you know, what you get with him coming off a game or at a sideline where you get like a worked up version. But yeah, I don't know. We'll see how that would go. All right, Stu, the next question, or this one I have found, it is from Brian J. McLaughlin. Hey, Bruce and Stu, thank you for your great work on all aspects of college football. Thank you, Brian. My question is Dave Clawson of Wake Forest the most underrated Power 5 head coach? He has turned around a couple of programs, now has Wake Forest, a tough place to win, undefeated so far this year. Mark Stoops and Tom Allen seem to be now more established names in the sport, and Jonathan Smith and Chris Klieman maybe a year or two away from hitting their respective strides. You agree with him?
I do agree with him. Now, I don't get the sense most people are all that familiar with Dave Clawson, and there's a reason why. It's not, I mean, Wake Forest is having a great season this year. They're undefeated. They're ranked fairly high. If you were just somebody who just looks at records, you would go, wait, what's the big deal with Dave Clawson? 3-9, 3-9, 7-6, 8-5, 7-6, 8-5, 4-5. They have gone to 5 straight bowl games, though. It's Wake Forest. I know they won that ACC title with Jim Grobe, but for the most, they are the smallest school in the Power 5. They're in Clemson's division, Florida State's division as well. And it's, you know, to be that, I mean, anybody, not anybody, but a lot of people could go in and have one good season or two good seasons. To turn them into a consistent bowl team is really something. And we'll see how this season ends up playing out. But right now, has a chance to be a really special year. And I think what's really unique about him is it's not like he came in and suddenly Wake Forest is recruiting a bunch of 4 and 5 stars. He has a very deliberate system. In fact, one of the reasons why I think this year is off to a great start for them is they are really benefiting from having these sixth-year guys back, because even in normal times, their roster or the guys that are playing are usually third, fourth, fifth-year guys. They try to redshirt everybody that comes into the program. They are, you know, very they don't shy away from the fact that it's a developmental program. And also, he's got a very unique offense. And if you ever watch a Wake Forest football game, it's kind of entertaining because you see some stuff you don't usually see, especially in the way they run the ball. So, but he never, you tell me, Mr. Coaching Carousel, do you ever hear his name mentioned for big jobs, or has he ever been like the hot, considered a hot candidate for anything?
I don't think he is not the type to campaign for it. I remember I reached out to him about something, and I think he knows who he is. He knows the identity of what he wants to run and where he wants to coach. And I think that makes him very selective in where he wants to be. You know, I have a somewhat embarrassing story, for me about him. Was a long, I don't know when it was, maybe like 6 or 7 years ago. I was at some function. I want to say it may have been in New York for the Football Foundation event, and it was something for the ACC. And a guy started talking to me, and we were like, I couldn't place him at first. And then within like, you know, it may have been like 2 minutes, and I was like, oh, this is Dave Clawson. Because I did not recognize him without, like, in a suit without his hat on. And he's somebody I've met a bunch of times. Now, it was probably the first time I'd seen him in like a while. And I just remember thinking, oh yeah, because I'm so used to seeing him with a hat on and he was in a suit. It was different. It just kind of threw me for a bit. And, you know, like as it turned out, like he is such a small school guy that he coached some guys I grew up with and used to play basketball with. So, you know, I have a little bit of history with him from, you know, this is, we're talking about in the beginning of his career. Like he was a GA and some of the guys he coached, I grew up with. You know, the thing you said about his system, I totally buy into, because I remember watching, you know, like if you're on a plane and you watch a game, it's almost like you're more invested in it than if you're on the couch, you know, like kind of, and they were playing BC. It might've been a Thursday night game. And, you know, Hartman was definitely the quarterback because he feels like he's been there for 20 years, but like you watched it and it was like, they are really do have a fun system to watch. And I think, you know, one of the things that has been cool to see about how they're thriving is, by the way, they lost the quarterback who everybody thought was like a huge free agent a year ago, who ended up going to Georgia, really didn't, you know, obviously do a ton, Jamie Newman. And they lost arguably the biggest impact transfer that anybody got this year in Kenneth Walker. And he's done great at Michigan State. And they're still winning. And it's like, you know, Wake Forest hit the jackpot with Grobe. I don't know what it was like 20 years ago or 15 years ago, probably 20 years ago, I guess. And I think they did again with Clawson. And except for that 1 year where he was on Fulmer's staff when everything was spiraling out of control, not his fault, he's been really good everywhere he's been. I don't know.
Yeah, I actually think that 1 year Tennessee kind of set him back, because that, you know, that he is mostly he was at Fordham. He was at Richmond. He would end up later at Bowling Green. These are not places people are really paying attention to. So when the time that he was like the most in the news was at Tennessee that 1 year, and he got fired. The whole staff got fired. So I think that probably set him back a little bit. But, you know, he's doing really well at Wake. That is pretty interesting. Like, imagine if Kenneth Walker was still on the team this year. They'd be even better, I assume, because he's really good.
So to button up Brian's question, yeah. I think we're in agreement. Yes, he is the most underrated Power Five head coach out there right now. Yes?
Yes. Hey, let's stick in the ACC. Aaron in Miami. Hey, Stu and Bruce, big fan of the pod. It felt like Saturday in Blacksburg was the type of game Pitt would normally blow, but they came out and dominated the Hokies. For the first time in decades, are the Pitt Panthers a legit top 15 team?
All right, Stu, I say yes. They have a really good quarterback. They are really good at getting pressure on the quarterback. Have some playmakers outside at receiver. I say yes. By the way, I think it's time you do a little mea culpa apology, because like 6 weeks ago, you were ready to sweep Pat Narduzzi out the door. And don't think I forgot.
That's true. I do remember that. They've been mediocre every year he's been there, but here they are, 5-1.
No. They have not been mediocre every
they
year.
They have. They've been a very mediocre program.
No. That's... Sorry. I can see where my mouth was about to go, and I was like, I don't need to add a... They've not been mediocre. They've had 3 8-win seasons there.
Well, maybe you have a different standard for mediocre.
That's not mediocre. They haven't been great. That's not mediocre. Mediocre is 5-7, 6-6 all over the place. It's not 8-win seasons.
His tenure up before this year, 8-5, 8-5, 5-7, 7-7, 8-5, 6-5. So he...
Do you know what his record is in the season, never, by the way?
6 seasons, and no, in none of those 6 seasons did they lose fewer than 5 games. You don't think that's mediocre?
I don't think it's mediocre. I don't think it's great. I think he's had a decent run there. I don't think it's mediocre. Now look, you can already read between the lines. I like Pat Narduzzi.
I like Pat Narduzzi too. He's really fun guy to cover.
Probably you don't.
I do like him. I would be thrilled for him if they end up winning the ACC. They did lose to Western Michigan. It was a 3-point score. I'm not gonna, say, oh, because of that they stink. They won at Tennessee, which at the time we didn't make a big deal of, but oh, by the way, Tennessee's turned out to be a lot better than we thought they would be, and they killed Georgia Tech and they've killed Virginia Tech. So I think they're definitely a good team. Top 15, debatable. Maybe top 20, top 25.
Gotta be Clemson.
Gotta be Clemson. They are, by the way, this is crazy. This is the first time in 5 years that Clemson is an underdog in a regular season game. I would not have... If you had said before the season Clemson's going to be an underdog against somebody this year for the first time in 5 years, I would have given you 5 choices, and you would not have thought Pitt was one of them.
By the way, I'm going to report back on this podcast on Sunday. I'm going to tell your friend Dave Wants that you said that Pitt is a mediocre program.
I did not say Pitt is a mediocre program. I said that that Pat Narduzzi has had a mediocre tenure, and I think if you give Wants that a truth serum, he'd probably agree.
We'll see about that. The guy doesn't lie. He's a walking truth serum. You've been around.
I'm saying if you were to ask, hey, Coach, how do you think about how Pitt – it's hard to have this conversation now that he's doing well, but like before the season, how do you think Pitt's been doing the last 5 years? Do you think he would have been like, really good?
No, I think he would say Steve Peterson sucks and then move on to whatever else.
Dave Wonsett must have gotten – I don't know if people read our in our coaching carousel series last week, Max Olson and Mitch Sherman did a fantastic story about the Nebraska coaching search that led to Bill Callahan. And, I've always heard bad things about Steve Peterson, but my gosh, in that story, the details that I think came from both Harvey Perlman, who was the president then, and the guy who was Steve Peterson's right-hand man, good Lord. I rarely heard of anybody handling a coaching search much worse than that.
All right, Stu, we'll move along. And Josh Boyd in Denver. Should Oregon make a change at quarterback? Can't really see what we're going to gain from continuing to play a 6-year quarterback that's playing average to below average. OU and Florida both made the change, and it's working out. I don't know about Florida making the change. So far it's not working out, whatever they're doing there. Alabama and Ohio State are both playing freshmen, yet our coaching staff seems adamant about not making a change. What do you think, Stu?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. I actually had a question on my mailbag this week about, why does it seem like coaches, Lincoln Riley being an example this year, they did bring up Dan Mullen. How are they like the last ones to see that it's time to make a quarterback change? And of course, a big part of it is we don't know what they're seeing in practice every day. And I think that, and not only do we not know what they're seeing in practice, even what they are seeing in practice could be deceiving, because quarterbacks can't be hit. And it's just not, I don't think you can simulate, the kind of decisions under pressure a QB has to make in a game on the practice field. So only, and this is a case where, okay, you're pushing for Ty Thompson, the highly touted freshman. Anthony Richardson got into games early in the season and showed flashes of what he could do. We haven't seen this guy at all. I mean, they have stuck with Anthony Brown through and through. So he is suggesting that Oregon, which right now is a top 10 team, I would argue they haven't been playing like one lately, but they are a top 10 team, should bench their sixth-year quarterback for a guy who we haven't even seen. I get it. I get that the freshman quarterback is always the most popular player on the team, and by no means do I think Anthony Brown has been playing well. But I just don't know if that's the answer. And I think these coaches, one of the reasons they're hesitant is Anthony Brown's not playing great, but it's not like he's out there throwing four interceptions every week. They worry that if they put in a freshman and the freshman's not ready, that he's going to cost them the game.
Yeah, Anthony Brown, by the way, Anthony Brown Jr. played really well in their big win at Ohio State. Let's give him that. He did play really well. He's also, you know, as much as he has been unspectacular, I think his numbers right now, 7 touchdowns, 1 interception, that's not bad, you know, in terms of what you're talking about. It's not, you know, it's not like, you know, I don't think they're great on the outside to begin with. They haven't been really good at receiver for a while. Again, I'm not making excuses to say that if they made a quarterback change, but again, I think there's been a lot of stuff going on there. And, you know, I know they're high on Ty Thompson. It's just maybe they're, as you said, maybe there's some extenuating things of why they feel like it's the best thing for them now to ride the more experienced guy.
I think you just brought up the key stat, 7 touchdowns, 1 interception. I think Mario Cristobal knows that he's got a really good defense. Losing CJ Verdell was not ideal, obviously, but they've still got Travis Dye. They can run the ball. That what he needs most from the quarterback position is to not turn it over. He probably feels like they can win most of their games with a defense that's going to hold teams to 17, 24 points and a quarterback that doesn't turn the ball over. Could be wrong. They play a UCLA team this week that's capable of scoring a lot of points, and it may be a game where they do need Anthony Brown to make some throws downfield and have some explosive plays. By the way, that is the game day game this week, Oregon at UCLA, the Chip Kelly Bowl, if you will. As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.